clear, but if the language is ambiguous, it can help the court in choosing between different interpretations. So I'm going to stop there and turn it over to Judge Rosenthal.
I was just looking at the blog that announces every Monday morning what the Supreme Court has done. Since they're an hour later, they've been busy while we've been sitting in here. And the top two cases that they issued this morning were exactly what we've been talking about, statutory interpretation cases. One about the Department of Labor's interpretation of its own regulations governing who is subject to overtime pay requirements and who's exempt from them. The issue, pretty important one, it affects a lot of people, are mortgage loan officers entitled to be paid overtime? Or not? And the issue all came down to what kind of deference you give to the Department of Labor's interpretations of the Federal Labor Standards Act. And did they properly apply their own interpretive rules? It's fascinating. Other case deals with passenger rail service. Totally different statute. Totally different effect on our lives. Same issues that we're talking about here today. And that's just this morning. Last week, we had the Affordable Care Act. It was nothing more than statutory interpretation, or nothing less. And we think back to the very beginning of the history of the Supreme Court. What was Marbury versus Madison in part doing? Interpreting the statute. One of the first that our then white new Congress enacted. Judiciary. Of course, it says important things about the Constitution along the way, in Article 3, but at bottom, it was interpreting a statute. And in our own lives, this is basically a big part of our day jobs. One of the reasons I very much like coming to talk to you all, and I do appreciate the invitation, thank you. I particularly appreciate the chance to hear from and work with Justice Bud Busby, who's just terrific. And think about, be reminded of, first of all, how central these issues are. Not just to us as judges, but to the basic institutions that define and inform how we as Americans live our lives. And how those lives are going to look in the near and far future. And what happens with the Affordable Care Act is going to really make a difference to a lot of people. And it will make a political difference. What happened in Marbury versus Madison, it is almost impossible to overstate the importance of that, right? And if you are thinking about your own careers as lawyers, and I certainly hope you are, these issues are your bread and butter. I don't care if you're doing transactional work or litigation. You are going to be drafting contracts if you're a transactional lawyer, negotiating, working on financial matters, giving advice that you will have to give in the shadow of the applicable statutes and regulations. You'll not only have to know about them, you'll know how to anticipate the arguments for interpreting them to serve your client's interests, and to defend or pursue whatever goals they have, and anticipate problems that might arise in the future, which means contrary interpretations, and figure out ways to protect against them, to draft, to avoid them, to advise your client at a minimum of potential risks. You have to know it no matter what area. If you want to do policy, forget this practice stuff. This is the policy. This is how you affect policy at the end of the day. If you want to advise public entities, if you want to go into city government, not just as politician, but working, representing cities, representing public entities, again, it's your bread and butter. And of course, if you are a trial lawyer, or an appellate lawyer, or both, which you certainly ought to start your careers as. This is what you do. So many cases are either all about the statutes or about a blend of statutes and other documents. Contracts under statutes. Insurance policies. We have an insurance code in Texas. So you look at the contract and at the policies, and then what you are doing is interpreting two different kinds of documents. So you are, without even consciously thinking of it in these terms, you are trying to figure out different ways of interpreting documents depending on the kind of instrument they are. Just this last week, I spent large parts of the day trying to figure out probable sexual interpretation. One in the context of an interesting challenge to a local highway project, which required me to look at both federal statutes, federal regulations, and state statutes and regulations, because the federal statute requires significant involvement of the Texas agencies, the Federal Highway Administration works closely with TxDOT, Texas Department of Transportation. They're each involved interpreting their own regulations, and the result is not always neat, particularly not for the judge. It's really difficult to overstate how critical this is. So I commend you on taking this course. If there are opportunities as you go forward to take similar kinds of courses, you should do. Because this will really stand you in good stead. Justice Buggy mentioned the Scalia Gardner book. I recommend that to you as well. But there is a book that just came out recently that is, I think, one of the most effective voices for a different approach to statutory interpretation. Both agree that you begin with the text. You start there. Same approach in interpreting contracts. You start with what the document says. And you really only worry about whether you should look to certain kinds of extrinsic sources, what role you give to these various canons of statutory interpretation, some of which are just tricked up rules of grammar. You only give weight to those, and you only engage in the debate about what's proper or not after you cross the threshold of figuring out that the words are not enough for you to come to a full conclusion, secure conclusion about what the parties meant, what they intended. I think they also agree that when you talk about what the parties intended, you're not talking about some kind of subjective intent. You really don't care about that. And it's not, and that's proper. Nobody has a notion that it's relevant to consider that when certain Texas legislatures, Texas legislature, or certain congressmen or senators had personal political ambitions in advancing or opposing particular legislation. care if they woke up in a bad mood that day, and that affected either their vote or what they settled for, or how they edited the committee report, fill in the blank. I do care about this notion of an objective intent of the legislature. And even though the textualists, such as Justice Scalia, who scorned legislative history as a permissible aid, and we'll talk about why, even though the textualists do talk, say that they don't want to consider intent in the sense of looking at the legislative history to gauge it, when you're looking at the text of the statute, you are trying to learn what the drafters intended. But what you mean by that is this objective notion of intent. What would a reasonable person reading these words believe the parties must admit to achieve by drafting it in this way? It is when we get to the point, as we often do, that we are unable to answer that question with any confidence, that we then have to resort to these other things. So you think of it as kind of a two-step dance. And then we have this raging debate about what's appropriate to look at and figure out when the words of the statute alone are incapable of giving us a secure answer. What can we look at to figure out what that answer? Some of the canons you would think would be beyond controversy. And yet, much of what we heard last week in the argument about the Affordable Care Act was over one of the most sacred of the canons, and one that I personally believe is the single most helpful. And that is stating the obvious. You read in context. When you're talking about six words of a statute, you cannot simply take them out of the sentence in which they are confound. You can't take that sentence out of the paragraph. You can't take that paragraph out of the rest of the statute. And if you're talking about even a very long statute, or a statute that is coupled with other documents that give it meaning, your task of putting it in context, of trying to read all the parts in harmony so that no part is read out or made meaningless by the way you read other parts, can be quite difficult. But it still seems to me to be the most sensible and anchoring discipline to bring to the enterprise of trying to figure out what ambiguous statutes should be written. And all of this raises an overarching question that I want to briefly touch on and then talk about some of the competing views of what we can and can't look at. The overarching question is, why is it so often important to go beyond simply the words of the statute or a regulatory scheme, the series of regulations that you may be looking for? Are the legislatures across this country, state and federal, and even municipal, we're talking about local ordinances too when we talk about regulations or statutes, are they that bad at their day jobs? They think about who works on Capitol Hill. They've got armies of newly minted lawyers whose job it is to draft. They've got committees, they've got legislative councils, they've got conference groups, they've got tons of resources. I think it's bad. And the enterprise gets played out when we look at statutes and regulations from all the agencies that have them. What goes on there? How can it be this poorly done over and over? I don't think it means that they're not doing their jobs. I do think it reflects the complexity of what their jobs are and the overall enterprise in which they're engaged. the role of compromise affects things. As Justice Busby said, sometimes the statutes are left intentionally ambiguous so that they can get through. And it is left to the regulators to try to fix what Congress has intentionally left open-ended, to try to make that more definite, more precise, more defined. And yet, there too, compromises have to occur. And then you can get arguments that because you can read the statute one way and the regulators may have chosen another way, are there therefore arguments that courts have to resolve about whether the regulators have misinterpreted what Congress intended them to do? You have difficult subject areas that are hard to put in a statute that can be read easily in one clear way. This is tough stuff. The regulations can be incredibly detailed. So you have two different kinds of challenge. How do you make things that are general, that are intended to be general, clear? And how do you make regulations that are incredibly long, incredibly detailed, a mix of very technical stuff, so technical that those who are tasked with drafting may not fully understand the technical stuff, and those that know the technical stuff may not understand the conventions of drafting. So you have sort of the worst of all worlds. A technical statute drafted by someone who doesn't know the technical stuff, and technical people advising them who have no idea how to draft it, is actually going to take place. That can produce what we then have to figure out. It's hard to craft health policy in the form of rules for the entire country. 300 million people. It's hard to figure out, look at the huge variety of employment in this country, employment relationships. It's hard to figure out what the national rules on who is entitled to be paid certain kinds of wages for certain kinds of work, certain amounts of work, under what conditions of work, what kinds of protections they're entitled to get. It's very hard to write those for the entire country. And yet, those are the kinds of things that we deal with on a mundane basis, and that you will as lawyers do. And then there are these conventions of drafting. Some of them can be quite helpful. Some of them need to be taken out and buried as quickly as possible, and yet they resist. I'll give you a very short example. For years, I've been involved in working on plain English changes to a variety of different kinds of legal documents, including rules. So in 2007, the entire body of certain rules, federal rules, were redrafted again in 2009, working on another one now. Basically a giant editing job. We took the entire rule book and edited it to bring it into the modern world and put it in something closer to plain English. Took out all the arcane stuff and all the whereases and stuff that made a lot more sense in 1938, given the writing conventions, the speaking conventions that applied and prevailed then, than they do to our modern eyes and modern ears. So we wanted these rules to kind of last into this new century, and we dragged them here. And in the process, we developed our own kind of rules for drafting that were much more plain English. And you can thank me whenever you want. Your federal rules of civil procedure are a whole lot easier to read, thanks to the work that many, many people did over a long period. When I was working in the rules committees, we actually drafted a new rule of evidence that, because of the way the rules structure works, we had to get Congress affirmatively to enact. Usually all they have to do is just back off and do nothing, and the rules that come out of the committee and the Enabling Act process become law if Congress doesn't get in the way. Well, this rule was different. So we went over to the Hill and we said to the Judiciary Committee, here's what we propose to do. It's not controversial. It's really easy. It's only going to help. We drafted it for you. You don't have to do a thing. And they looked at it and said, thank you very much. And then followed a year of negotiating a proposed change that no one opposed. Okay? One of the things that they did during that process is take this beautifully written, clear, new rule and put it back in old, ugly statutory language. So instead of a rule that very simply said, here's what you got to do and here's what you can't do, they brought back something very proudly that said, and whereas we, the people of the United States, find that there is this great need for this new provision, you shall not do, and it will therefore not be permitted to refrain from or engage in. It was tricked up beyond measure. It was in the passive voice. It used words you hadn't seen or heard, except in bad legal writing, for a very long time. And it was almost impossible to follow. And they said, this is the way it has to be enacted. That's how we do it here. I was horrified. But it was a perfect window into one of the problems. There are conventions of writing legislation and regulations that persist, and they don't follow the way that people write today, except in that context. How they read, how they interpret. And that's the problem. It will become an increasing problem. And I'm worried that there doesn't seem to be any felt need on the part of the legislatures, at least on the federal level, to improve that process. Two other points that I want to briefly make on legislative history. The problem with this argument between thou shalt never use legislative history and you can use whatever kind of legislative history you want, whatever's there, is that both are wrong and both are right. Justice Scalia has given incredible force to this argument that legislative history is meaningless because it is manipulated. It is not ever reliable in his judgment. And he's right, sometimes. Committee reports are often, or conference reports, or whatever is in the congressional record, are often written by lawyers slash lobbyists whose job it is to provide a legislative history that describes the agenda that their group, view, interests have in pursuing the legislation. And it is often written to tell people how to interpret it, so as to achieve that agenda. Glossing over things that may have been left open-ended, left ambiguous, left for debate outside of the legislative arena and the political pressures and the need for compromise that obtains there. other side that has recently been added that I commend to you is a book by Judge Robert Katzman, who's now the Chief Judge of the Second Circuit. It's called Judging Statutes. It's here, a lot thinner, which is commendable. And he comes out very strongly in favor of what he calls the purposeful, purposivist, can't even say it. But you try to glean the purpose of legislation. He rejects Justice Scalia's approach that you can't think about the purpose as overly simplistic. The textualists are incorrect in saying they're not all about the purpose, because they don't. That's why they're looking at the words of the text to start with, trying to figure out the objectively discernible intent from the words. And when you can't figure it out from the words, you're still trying to figure out the purpose that the legislature had in drafting. Now, how do you ascribe purpose to this big body? If that's what we're all arguing about. But they had to have had a purpose. It's not any individual's subjective intent, as we said, but that doesn't mean that they were stainless. So legislative history is flawed. But it is often written conscientiously, thoroughly, and with an eye towards advising those who will be trying to interpret it and apply it to specific factual contexts that may not have been envisioned at the time. Another reason this problem comes up so often, particularly with statutes that have been around for a while, and you have to apply statutes that were drafted in a much earlier age when the technology looked nothing like it did then, it does now. Commerce was very different. You have to apply very old wine to brand new bottles. And that's a problem for interpreting statutes that we often encounter. So read both of them, because I do think they're both right. And that's what makes it both hard and interesting. There will be times when you will want to rely on legislative history and you're comfortable that, well, it's not dispositive. It can at least be helpful. There are other times when you will read it or you will understand that it is a political speech and should either be discounted or disregarded because it is not reliable. It is not helpful. And the trick is knowing which one is true in a given context, given situation. So the final point that he makes, and this goes back to something that Brett said, and then actually picked up one of the questions that was presented by one of you, and I'm going to end with that, and then invite you all to give more questions. Are there differences? Well, one of the points that Judge Katzman makes is that in order to understand statutes and how to interpret them and what the proper role of things like legislative history is, you have to understand how the legislative process works. So in this nice slender volume, he gives a very short but really helpful description of how the legislative process in Congress works. And as I listened to Justice Busby, the thought struck me that if that premise is right, that you can't interpret statutes without understanding the process that generated them, does that mean that I have to become a student now of the Texas legislature and its process? And if I am interpreting statutes from another state, is it now incumbent on me to go figure out if their legislative process is different in a way that matters? I'm going to be a very busy person. Justice Busby spends a lot of time interpreting federal statutes as well as state statutes, because Texas often has statutes that say, I think we pretty much follow what the feds do here. And I spent a lot of time looking at Texas statutes because they're the law that applies in a particular case. So whether you do a primarily state practice or a primarily federal practice, you're each going to be spending time in our backyards. But that's pretty daunting if I have to know the legislative process of every for every state that produces a statute that I've got to deal with applying. But statutory interpretation requires you to learn and therefore teaches you a great deal. And that's part of what makes it so interesting. It's not just weapons for you to use in your practice, although that's critical. And it's not just understanding a particular case. It lets you think about both language, how to use words, how words are chosen, what it means to communicate effectively, and how to do that. Words have consequences. And what statutory interpretation reminds you of is just that, the power of words and the importance of words. And it not only lets you think about language, it lets you think about the institutions that create the rules that govern how we all live. And then the institutions that shape those rules, regulations, the administrative agencies, and finally the courts. So in this early morning class, you're thinking about the great issues. You pick the good class. One of the questions that was asked was, is it ever proper for us, if we've got a problem with Texas, with how to interpret a Texas statute, pick up the phone and call a Texas legislator who we know, who was involved in the draft, or somebody who we don't know, except we know that they were involved in drafting this one. Maybe it was the chief sponsor. Is it ever proper to call them up and say, or her up and say, I've got this in front of me. Can you explain to me precisely what was meant by this provision, which I concluded is really ambiguous, at least in the context of the fact pattern that I have. Is it ever proper to do that?
No.
Why not? It would be so helpful.
Well, it would be, but you know, the average person who's reading that statute is not going to be able necessarily to do that when they're reading it. And so, you know, we have to rely on, you know, much as I'm used to doing on appeal, we've got a whole record in front of us of you know, sort of how the process played out. And my view is that's what we're supposed to decide the case on. Now, there is a place for interaction, to be sure, between the legislative and judicial branches, and actually Chief Justice Heck just addressed this in his State of the Judiciary address to the legislature and suggested that we create what they have done previously on the federal level and was tried to be done in the 70s in Texas, which is a sort of a joint working group between the legislature and the judicial branch that would have a dialogue about how can statutes be more drafted more clearly on the front end so that there are fewer of these questions on the back end, ambiguities. And I think that's an entirely proper exercise as a prospective matter for the courts and the legislature to engage in. But once it's down on paper, my view is you should respect what's there on the record, not try to inject additional information from particular legislators who may not have even thought about the problem when they passed the statute. And subjective intent, as Judge Rosenthal so rightly explained, is really not the question in front of us. And what you're going to be getting if you call a particular legislature is their subjective impression of what they would have thought about this question if they had thought about it at all at the time the statute was passed. So those are my two cents on that. And I think just to throw in one other thing about legislative history, and I didn't have a chance to say this earlier, but And this goes a little bit to another question that was asked, which is how have our methods of statutory interpretation changed since we moved from private practice to the bench? And one of the ways that they've changed is now I have to pick one and go with it. Whereas in practice, you can argue all of them that are helpful to you. And I encourage you to do that. If legislative history is helpful to your particular problem, definitely argue it. Where you put it in the hierarchy of your argument is should be affected by what the court you're in front of tells you is the role of legislative history. But I definitely encourage you to rely on it if it's helpful, because as Judge Rosenthal says, sometimes it is and sometimes it's not, and the trick is figuring out which it is. But in practice, I would say it's changed because now I have to pick one. You pick among these methods and figure out which are most informative, whereas in practice, I would say argue all that are helpful to you.
Well, I agree. Questions?
We know you have lots of good ones because we've read them, so please.
Yes. Well, first, I just wanted to thank you for coming out today in this weather and sharing your perspective with all of us. In talking each of you, said you began with the language of the text, the contract, and said the first purpose is to find the plain meaning of that text. And if there's any ambiguity, to go on to the canons. So I was asking what the fact that these interpretations are being litigated, that seems to me to bring a presumption of ambiguity and in turn beg to use the canons as evidence.
Yeah, there's a famous canon about using the canons, which is deals with how you find ambiguity in the first place. So what does it mean for a statute or indeed a contract provision to be ambiguous? It has to be more than the fact that people disagree. If that was enough, then any time a dispute arose, we'd be looking for extrinsic evidence, right and left. Think about contracts for a minute, which are documents, right? So you want, usually, sometimes you have oral agreements, but let's stick to written words that have some permanence that presumably people thought about drafting. Pick some words instead of others. If you look at a contract, we have a rule of evidence called the parole evidence, which says that unless ambiguity is established, you can't look to extrinsic evidence of prior understandings to displace or contradict or nullify the words of the contract itself. Okay? You just can't even look at it. That would go out the window if we adopted the notion that the mere fact that there's a plaintiff and a defendant and they disagree is enough to find ambiguity. Sometimes, you know, you get into some sort of more interesting questions, which is, what do you do when you have not just the parties disagreeing, but I'm sitting there trying to figure out a statute or regulation, and I'm looking at my brother and sister in the Eastern District of Texas that have looked at the same issue in a very similar context, and they think it means one thing. And then I've got another buddy over in Southern District of New York who has looked at the same statute of regulation in a similar context and concluded it means the other thing. Neither one found it ambiguous. They disagreed. Circuit judges, there could be circuit splits. Both finding the same language, both unambiguous and meaning different things. So does that, when you get judges disagreeing, first trial judges, then appellate judges, does that mean, say you get a dissent, does that mean it's ambiguous? Or just that one side right and one side wrong? So I don't think it's that simple. And I don't think that the courts think it's that simple. Disagreement does not equal ambiguity. But disagreement can be one sign of ambiguity. So it's not irrelevant, but it can't be dispositive.
Other questions?
Well, we're going to warn you, we've got some questions.
question right here that you've already submitted, so feel free to either add to them, present them orally, or come up with entirely new.
Yeah, you had mentioned how attorneys often craft an argument to the judges, maybe an intent argument or a text argument. But as a judge yourself, do you look to the higher court, the appeals court above you, and you know maybe all of them are textualists or something else? Does that factor in into how you write your opinions or orders and seeing how they would be looked on later on?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if they have said something in a particular case about how they approach statutory interpretation, we're bound to follow that. Not only as a matter of precedent, are we required to do that, but it's also good common sense if you want to get it right and you want your work to stand up, to higher court scrutiny, that you can follow that as well. So yeah, I definitely look at the way that the Texas Supreme Court or the Court of Criminal Appeals are interpreting statute, which is not always the same, by the way. So it depends on whether it's a criminal case or a civil case. I have to look to two high courts, depending on which type of case it is. But yes, I definitely do that.
I think that's an interesting question for both lawyers and for, has long been called, without meeting any offense, inferior, or judges of inferior courts. I am very much a judge of an inferior court, but that's okay. It's not about moi. It's complicated because you're talking about two different kinds two different ways of thinking about what higher courts do that either bind or influence lower courts. So one way is just precedent. I mean, the Fifth Circuit says, this is how you interpret this statute in this context. Fine. My work is easy. I may not like it, but I've got to do it. But what if it's a court like the Fifth Circuit, and there's no precedent, there's no case that says this statute is legal? But I'm looking at the likely composition of different panels, and there's all sorts of numerical possibilities, right? And some of the judges on that court, I know, are dyed-in-the-wool textualists. They would no sooner pick up a piece of legislative history than they would, cite foreign law. They just think it's irrelevant. There are other members of the court who believe that it is important to look at it, but it is important to look at it. There are members of the court who do not walk around with, I belong to this school of interpretation, and blazoned on their jackets, who are either just don't have a track record, you don't know about it, or they try to avoid bright line rules because they're suspicious of them, in general. Which some say may be the hallmark of a really good judge. So what do you do when you're dealing with that kind of possibility? You're not bound by anything. You can't even figure out how you want to craft it to avoid reversal. And that's really the key right there. You're not really usually drafting your opinions to avoid reversal. You're mindful of that. You sure don't want to invite it. But your first and foremost task as a trial judge, especially, when you don't have a full and polished record, that's what is being generated on your watch, is to get it right. You gotta get it right. And that means following the law that applies and understanding the facts accurately. But there are a lot of shades of gray. So I'm not usually writing it thinking, well, if I get this panel, this is what's likely to happen. If I get this panel, that's what's likely to happen. I mean, I would never speak when I drive myself nuts, and I'd be a pretty bad judge. So it's really hard to figure it out. And if you're a lawyer, you're arguing before me, I'm sort of the go ahead and figure it out. Am I an O or a P person? am I an originalist? Am I a textualist? Am I a purposivist? Good luck on that one. And I suspect Justice Busby doesn't have it emblazoned on his forehead. And he's even more complicated to figure out if you're arguing in his court, because he's got two other members of his panel. And how are you going to guess that? So my advice to his lawyers is, if you're aware that someone really is, that one of your decision makers has a very clear agenda, very set views, publicly announced either through opinions or otherwise, on an interpretive approach, of course be mindful. But that generally cannot be, particularly if you're looking down the road to an appeal, the future, that cannot be the only thing you gear your argument towards.
Other questions? Yes, ma'am. Great question, and it's a hard question, but I think it depends on how clear you think the precedent is of the court above you. I mean, if it's very clear that you have to rule a certain way in a particular case, it's the obligation of the oath that we took to follow that, even if we don't agree with it or resign. And so, you know, what you can do is say, I would encourage the higher court to reconsider this. And on my bench, we have the opportunity, since there are multiple members of the panel, to write a concurrence to say, you know, and I did this recently in a case where it was a contract case where the case had been up to the Texas Supreme Court once already, and it came back, and I got assigned to the panel on the second time that our court had gotten it. And I didn't think that the Texas Supreme Court's opinion had some language in it that I thought foreclosed a certain argument. And so I wrote a concurrence and I said, I think we're bound by what the Supreme Court said. And incidentally, the Texas Supreme Court has a very broad interpretation of what we're supposed to follow, and it includes their dicta. So unlike in federal courts where you don't have to follow the court's dicta, the dicta of the court above you, we are required to follow the Texas Supreme Court's dicta. And so I thought that their dicta said we had to come out a certain way. But just reading the record, I thought there was no factual support for that particular remedy under this contract. And so I wrote a concurrence and said, here's the way, you know, I'm agreeing with my colleague that says this is the way we have to read their dicta. But if you look at this page of the record, I don't think they've proven their entitlement to that. So if I were considering this for the first time, I would go the other way. And they did end up sending it back to us. So now we have to decide what they said. No, we didn't say that, which I think they did. But we're now free to consider that. So that's an example of an appropriate use of, you know, respectful suggestions that there might be another way to look at it.
And for a one-judge trial court, it's a little bit different. So what I try to do in those kinds of situations is, if I really think I'm bad, it's pretty, I'm done. And the most I can do in that kind of circumstance, I could engage in what I call judicial whining. I really don't like, it's not helpful. I have in some cases written opinions in which I say, here's the result I have. But I do recognize certain costs or harsh consequences from this result. And I think it is important for at least the parties for me to document my recognition that they are present. They cannot change the outcome. And it's a kind of feel your pain point, but it can be an important thing to do. It also helps signal to an appellate court that there may be important aspects in which the reading consider if for whatever reason I don't feel comfortable and say, you guys really need to get rid of this or change this. Which is a second alternative. Sometimes my colleagues will write opinions to the appellate court in which they will say, wrong, wrong, and wrong. Do something. Do it now. Next chance you get, put this in bank, because in the Fifth Circuit, they can't, one panel can't overrule another panel. It has to go in bank for the full court to do so. And urging the trial court, urging the Fifth Circuit to take a case and take it in bank, I find a little bit awkward, so I generally don't do that, but that's a second alternative. Third alternative is really something that you see sometimes in the Supreme Court with dissents and concurrences. Of course, one judge courts don't write dissents or concurrences. And that is, you interpret a statute in a particular way, but then you tell Congress that something they already know. You don't like it, you know what to do. You can amend it, you can change it. Now, the question that I think we'll end with, because I see that we're about to run out of time, is, does that make sense? Is that meaningful in this day and age? It always used to be one of the kind of canons of statutory interpretation that you're interpreting it in the shadow of recognizing that if Congress doesn't like the way you've interpreted it, Congress can change it. Is that true today, when at least on a national level, we are famous, we're looking at a Congress that is famous now for its seeming inability to get anything done. There was a great quote in this morning's paper about Mitch McConnell saying, I don't have 216 votes to declare a bathroom break. they can't do a thing unless they are faced with extraordinary pressure or on a financial brink. There's a national security crisis growing somewhere in the world. Think back to not that far in the past when the Supreme Court in a fraction of opinion construed the Equal Pay Act, Title VII, in a case involving wage discrimination on the basis of sex. Women get paid less than men for doing the same or similar work. Lilly Ledbetter sued, Supreme Court said, oh, you know what, you waited too long, and in fact, there was a real issue about when she was able to learn about the disparity in pay between herself and her male colleagues. So, Supreme Court said, we're reading the statute as written. Congress did not permit you, egregious as the disparity was, as good a worker as you apparently were, we're not going to let you bring the statute. You're stuck. And so are all the women just like you. And Congress changed it. The Lilly Ledbetter Act. Congress literally rewrote the statute to allow her and others to sue without being barred by limitations as they had construed it. So we're not very far away from that. That was in the Clinton administration, if I remember right. Not that long ago. Have things changed so much that we can no longer rely on that, or even think about it? It's a good question. It's a really good question. But it does underscore the correctness of the point that you can't consider a statute without considering the process that gave rise to it if you are in a situation of a result that seems untenable, or unfair, or words that simply don't easily lend themselves to clear understanding.
Well, please join me in thanking Judge Rosenthal and Justice Douglas.